Good evening, everybody. Let's start with our meditation on the Buddha, like we usually do. And before we do that, do a little bit of meditation on the breath, letting the mind relax and release all the, or at least some of the distracting thoughts by watching our breath. So do that for a couple of minutes, and then we'll visualize the Buddha and do the short meditation. So in the space in front of you, visualize the Buddha seated on a throne with lotus, sun, and moon seats. The entire visualization is made of light, very bright and beautiful. So the Buddha's in the center and he's surrounded by many different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So really feel like you're in the presence of a great multitude of holy beings. And then reflect that you're also sitting in the midst of a huge congregation of sentient beings all around you, as far as the eye can see. And just like us, they want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. And they're looking for a method to alleviate their misery and bring about the peace and joy that they want. And so we imagine leading them in taking refuge in the three jewels, as that is a way to lead them on the path to the alleviation of suffering and the attainment of peace and joy. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. Then as you're saying the four immeasurables, reflect on the meaning of the words. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. And really wish that for them and for yourself. Then to purify and accumulate merit, we'll do the seven limbs, the mandala offering. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offerings, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtue of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great awakening. This ground anointed with perfume, flowers strewn Mount Meru, four lands, sun and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you. May all beings enjoy this pure land. The objects of attachment, aversion, and ignorance, friends, enemies, and strangers, my body, wealth, and enjoyments, I offer these without any sense of loss. Please accept them with pleasure and inspire me and others to be free from the three poisonous attitudes. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandalakam Niryatayami. Then a replica of the Buddha in front comes and sits on the crown of your head, facing the same way you do. And also replicas of the Buddha come on the heads of all the other beings around you. And we petition the merit field in front. Glorious and gracious Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness. Bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind, the eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion. To the entire line of spiritual mentors I make request. And then as we say the Buddha's mantra, think that incredible light comes from the Buddha into us, into all the sentient beings. This is from the Buddha's on our heads and purifies our negativities and resistance and obstacles to understanding the Dharma, and brings with it a open, receptive mind that understands the teachings. Taya ta muni muni maha muniya soha. 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 Taya ta om muni muni maha. Soha. And then contemplating the Buddha on the crown of your head, then think, in relationship to I and mine, first arises the thought that they are inherently established. Then, on the basis of this mode of apprehension of the I, arise various kinds of wrong thinking, such as attachment to what is on my side, anger towards what is on the other side, conceit that deems me superior to others. On their basis arise doubt and wrong views that deny the existence of the guide who taught selflessness of his teaching. They deny the existence of karma and its effects, the four truths of the Aryas, the three jewels, and so forth. And based on these, all the other afflictions develop. And having accumulated karma under their influence, I am obliged to experience a wide variety of dukkha, or unsatisfactory conditions in cyclic existence. Therefore, ultimately, the root of all dukkha is ignorance. And then appeal to the Guru Buddha on your head. May I, by all means, attain the state of a Guru Buddha that frees me from the root of all samsara's dukkha. For that purpose, may I correctly train in the qualities that are the three precious higher trainings. In particular, may I correctly guard the ethical disciplines to which I have committed myself, even at the cost of my life, since guarding them is beneficial and failing to do so is extremely harmful. In response to your requesting the Guru Buddha, five colored light and nectar stream from all the parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. The light and nectar absorb into your body and mind and into those of all the sentient beings around you, purifying all negativities and obscurations accumulated since beginningless time. And especially purifying all illnesses, interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with correctly developing the good qualities that are the three higher trainings once you have generated the aspiration to liberation. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light, and think that all your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth, expand and increase. And then think that having generated the aspiration to liberation, that a superior realization of correct cultivation of the three higher trainings, ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, has arisen in your mind stream and in the mind stream of others. So last week we were talking about the second of the four truths of the Aryas, or Noble Ones. The first one being true dukkha, or the unsatisfactory conditions, and the second being the causes or origin of that dukkha. And then the third and fourth are true cessations, and then the path to that cessation of dukkha and its causes. So in talking about the causes, we talked about attachment, our old pal attachment, our friend anger, that protects us from all those horrible people, conceit, ignorance, and doubt. Okay, and then the sixth one, because these six form a set called the six root afflictions, are called afflictive views. But before getting into afflictive views, I want to talk a little bit more about what we, well, not more, I just want to talk about, because I haven't started it yet, what we call the four distortions, or the four distorted conceptions. Okay, so I'm going to read you a verse from the Anguttara Nikaya. That's a collection of sutras. This sutra is called Distortions of Perception. It's in the Pali Canon. Okay, so it says, those who perceive the changing to be permanent, suffering or dukkha as bliss, a self in the selfless, and those who see the foul as the mark of beauty, such folks resort to wrong views. Mentally deranged, subject to illusions, caught by Mara. Mara is the personification of hindrances. Not free from bonds, they are still far from the secure state. Such beings wander through the painful round of cyclic existence and go repeatedly from birth to death. But when the Buddhas appear in the world, the makers of light in a mass of darkness, they reveal this teaching, the noble Dharma, that leads to the end of dukkha. When people with wisdom listen to these teachings, they at last regain their sanity. They see the impermanent as impermanent. They see the unsatisfactory as unsatisfactory. They see the selfless as empty of self. And in the foul, they see the foul. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all dukkha. Okay. So it was talking at the beginning about these four distorted ways of seeing things, okay? So one is seeing what is changing or impermanent by nature as permanent. Second is what is this is the order in the sutra, okay? What is by nature unsatisfactory as blissful. Third is seeing a self in what is actually lacks a self. And then the fourth one here, which is often in other listings the first one, is seeing the foul as having the mark of beauty. Seeing what is foul as beautiful. Okay. So, let me describe them, and you can check if you have these in your mind. Okay. And then think about what they, how they cause you to apprehend things, how they cause you to feel the effect that they have on your life. Let's start actually with that fourth one, which actually comes first in many lists. Okay. So, in what is foul, we see beauty. Okay? So, this is shocking for people at the beginning. Take the body, for example. Okay, we see the body as beautiful, isn't it? I mean, that advertising, the body is beautiful. And we do everything we can to make our body beautiful. You know, dye our hair and put on good clothes and, you know, try and gain weight if you're too thin, lose weight if you're too fat, wear nice clothes, comb your hair in the right way. You know, we try and make the body very, very attractive, you know. Not only for sexual partners, but just because we think that if our body is attractive, people will like us. And if our body isn't attractive, people won't like us. And of course, we all want to be liked. Right? Is this true? Yeah? So it's not just high school kids that think this way. You know, it's adults as well. Okay, but what is the body? Is the body, you know, by its own nature, something beautiful? Okay. If you look just on the outside of the body, anything that comes out of any of the physical, of the body's orifices, we want to clean away ASAP. Yeah. So none of what the body produces is exceptionally lovely. Yeah. And if we were to peel away the skin and see what was under the skin, then is that something beautiful? Yeah? You peel it away, you see the muscles, you see the tissues. Yeah, there's the bones underneath and the ligaments. Then in your belly, you know, you have your liver and your gallbladder. What a beautiful gallbladder. You know, and your pancreas and your spleen and those intestines. My golly, beautiful intestines, huh? It's reminding me of that song you wrote. Yeah, should get you to sing it. Okay. And then the blood, the lymph, yeah, the brain, beautiful brain, you know. The esophagus, lungs. Okay, beautiful or not beautiful? Yeah. Well, you know, we kind of, when we look at it that way, it's not so beautiful. But when we cover it up with skin, then we think it's beautiful. But if you just took the skin alone and put it in a pile over here, would that skin be beautiful? Yeah. When we look at people, you know, your eyes are like diamonds and your teeth are like pearls. Okay, so there are the two eyes. Yeah? Are they still so beautiful? Yeah? You take the teeth out, line them up here. Yeah, maybe put the eyelashes somewhere. And then the hair, you know, a clump of hair. Yeah. Maybe attached to the scalp. A couple of ears. Yeah. And that neck that is not flabby. Yeah. When you just take the face and you put it out there, is it beautiful? Okay, so is our usual way of relating to the body, seeing it as something beautiful, is that a correct conception, or is that a distorted mode of apprehension? Distorted. Well, you kind of say that reluctantly. Distorted. But really, But really, when you look at it, it's not beautiful, is it? Okay. So the mind that sees these things as beautiful is distorted. It's not in line with reality. Shantideva has a great section in chapter 8 of Guide to Bodhisattva's Way of Life, you know, having you look at the body and what is it you want to embrace in somebody else's body, you know. That liver, wow, really turns me on. Yeah. Look, it's like, what's going on with us? Yeah, so much distortion. Then the second one is when you practice mindfulness of the body, this is what you hone in on and you meditate on. Then seeing what is changing, what is impermanent. Impermanent means not remaining the same in the second moment. So seeing what is impermanent as unchanging, as static, as always there, secure, guaranteed there. Okay. So when we look at our friends and relatives, you know, we think that they're always there, and our relationships with them are permanent. Yeah, our job is permanent. So you think. Yeah, the world is permanent. Everything else, I mean, things, yeah, they kind of change, but actually they don't. You know, that's the way we see things. So we're so surprised when people die, because somehow they aren't supposed to. Yeah, we thought that people were stable and eternal. And so how can death happen? Yeah, do you know, even when somebody's terminally ill for months and months, on the day they die, people are surprised. Yeah, they weren't supposed to. They're supposed to always be there. And yet all these things, because they're produced by causes and conditions, by their very nature, they are changing in every split second. Okay? So it causes us a lot of problems because we don't really accept that changeable nature of things, and we want everything to be stable and secure and unchanging. Yeah? So let alone be surprised when people die. Yeah? When we spill spaghetti sauce on our new furniture, we're also surprised because somehow that new furniture is supposed to be permanently clean. Yeah? You ever thought about that? How surprised we are when things change. Okay? So that distortion also causes us a lot of grief. And then we see things that are unsatisfactory by nature as blissful, as pleasurable. Okay? So we see eating as like so pleasurable. But if it were really pleasurable, the more you ate, the happier you would be. Is that true? The more you eat, you just keep eating and eating and eating. Do you get happier and happier and happier? Or do you get a stomach ache? Okay. So we see eating, which is as, you know, something pleasurable, but actually, by its own nature, it isn't. Because if we keep doing it, it becomes painful. Yeah. We see going to Disneyland as pleasurable. But imagine in being in Disneyland 5 days straight, no break. Morning till night, night till morning. Is it going to be pleasurable? Or are you going to be screaming for some quiet? Yeah. So, you know, all the things in cyclic existence that we look at, that we think will bring us pleasure, you know, this relationship, finally, the right partner, this one's going to make me happy. Yeah, we say that with every single one of them. Don't we? Yeah? Every single one is going to be the person that we are everlastingly happy with. But of course, that changes after a while. Yeah? Or every job, the perfect job. Yeah? But again, if it were really pleasurable, then working all day and working all night, you would just be happier and happier. Okay? So something's wrong with our perception there. We see things that by nature are not pleasurable, you know, because if you keep doing them, they bring you outright discomfort and pain. But we see them as pleasurable. And then fourth, we see things that do not have a self as having a self. Okay? So here, there's many definitions of what self can mean. I'm going to use the one from the Prasangika system. You know, meaning self here, meaning inherent existence. So everything appears to us as if it has its own essence, its own inherent nature, independent of causes, conditions, parts, the mind that conceives and labels it. You know, we see people and things as self-enclosed, identifiable units. Yeah? And yet they aren't like that at all. Because when you search to find out what anything is, yeah, you can't really find it. Yeah, when you ask yourself, well, who am I? And then you go through every single identity that you've ever had. Yeah, from Girl Scout to, you know, plagiarist. yeah. Every identity you have, are you that? Yeah. Is your body you? Is your mind you? You know, we can't find any sort of identity there that we can say, this for sure is the essence of me. And so also that misperception causes us a whole lot of problems. You know, because when we grasp on to these different identities that we have and think, you know, I am that, then when other people don't agree that we're that identity, or when other people don't treat us as we think we should be treated if we have that identity, or if other people are prejudiced against that identity, then we're up in arms about it. Okay? So we get attached to, you know, for example, I'm American. So therefore, everywhere I go, the world should meet what I want. Yeah? Or whatever ethnic group you belong to. Yeah? Because each ethnic group has its own story about itself. I am this ethnic group, therefore, you know, other people see me like this, and our ethnic group has these kind of traits. Okay? But then when somebody doesn't agree with that, we get upset. Okay? So any kind of you know, identity, if somebody is prejudiced against our ethnic group, or our gender, or our sexual orientation, or our nationality, or our religion, or anything like this, then we are very offended and hurt and enraged, and we're going to go fight back. Yeah. So that's just because of thinking that I am those identities. Yeah. Now, I am this, therefore people should treat me. But da 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 da. And if they don't, well, by golly, I'm going to clobber them. Okay, so these four distortions cause us a lot of trouble in our lives, and they set the foundation for the arising of many of the afflictions. So, for example, because we see what is foul, such as the body, as beautiful, then we generate a lot of attachment to the body. Yeah, since we see suffering, things that are unsatisfactory by nature, such as romantic relationships. Now you're going to look at me like, what? Romantic relationships are not unsatisfactory by nature. They're wonderful. If they were wonderful, then how come Hollywood makes so many movies about them and the people are always fighting? Yeah? If they're so wonderful, how come the divorce rate is so high? Okay? So we see things that, you know, are unsatisfactory by nature as being, you know, the pleasurable. And then, again, we suffer as a result of it. Or we see things that are by nature, you know, arising and ceasing, disintegrating in each moment. Again, like our body, you know, body getting older every moment, but yet we see it as permanent, then that causes us a lot of grief too. Yeah? Because then when we look in the mirror and we're old, it's like such a surprise. Yeah? How did this happen to me? That only happened to my parents and grandparents. Yeah. But now they're all dead and I'm the oldest generation. Oh my golly, what's happening? Yeah. I remember being the kids' generation. But now all the kids look at me and I'm part of the dinosaurs. Okay. So not accepting change and impermanence also causes us much unhappiness, you know, when things change and we don't expect that change or want that change. Yeah, we're unhappy. And then, you know, afflictions arise. Things change that we don't want. We're unhappy because we're attached to those things. So we get angry. Or we get jealous of people who still have those things because impermanence is happening there, but not grossly for them yet. So they still think that they have it. Okay, so we get jealous or we get arrogant because we think we have something better than others because we're thinking that what is by nature unsatisfactory is fantastic. So then we get proud over our career, over our music ability, our athletic ability, our artistic ability, you know, whatever ability we have, we get arrogant over that.
Is the feeling aggregate that perceives these as positive, or is it the feeling aggregate that perceives these as positive when they're not necessary?
No, the feeling aggregate just experiences pleasure, displeasure, and neutrality. But with all these four distortions, it's the mental. Yeah, I mean, it's not just the consciousness aggregate, because it's actually there's elements of the other aggregates in there too, because you have to have attention and some concentration, and you know, and then there's feeling and discrimination, and yeah, so there's other things in there too to make that whole distortion. Yeah. Okay, so these distortions, you know, lay the foundation for the afflictions, and then we can see in our life when the afflictions come up, then we act. Yeah. And the, you know, because the afflictions are disturbing, because they are not based on an accurate perception of reality, then the actions we do are, you know, are not actually fitting for the situation, because they're not based on a real sense of the reality of the situation. Okay, and so then a lot of, you know, negative karma can ensue. Sometimes there's some positive karma we create as well, yeah, but very easy to have the negative karma, and then that becomes the source for the different situations we encounter in which we are, you know, experience grief and distress and so forth. Okay, so this kind of teaching can be a little bit shocking, you know. It doesn't kind of match our image of, you know, I'm a happy, carefree person. But when we look, it's true. Yeah? Don't you think? You know, spend some time really thinking about these four and see if you have these four distorted, you know, minds or apprehensions or conceptions in your mind, and then see how they function in your life. Yeah. And then we get some, from that, we get some energy to be free of them, because we see the pain that they bring us. And then that gives us, you know, the wish to be free of cyclic existence. You know, the renunciation of being born again and again and again in a body and mind like this that are caused by ignorance, afflictions, and polluted karma. Okay? So it's not to, you know, you can make this kind of teaching depressing, or you can realize that this is the way things are, whether you accept it, whether you like it or not. You know, it's like, this is the way it is. So there's no sense getting depressed about it. There is some sense about trying to counteract it. Okay, and so then we go about learning the Dharma and the Dharma methods and how to understand reality correctly, because that will help us counteract these distorted mental states. Okay, so now we're going to go back to the... we finished deluded doubt last time, didn't we? Yeah. So now we're going to go back to the afflictive views. Okay. So the six root afflictions that we've been going through, yeah, and the four distortions underlie them, okay? These six can be categorized into views and non-views. Okay, so some of these six are views. They're like ways of perceiving or apprehending ourselves and the things around us. And other ones are non-views, and they're more emotional. Okay, so for example, attachment, anger, yeah, conceit, doubt, these things are more on the emotional side. You know, ignorance is more on the view side, but you know, some people don't consider it so much a view. They just see it as an obscuration, a general cloudiness. So for them, part of it may be like a little bit on the non-view side. Okay. But the ones of afflictive views, there's five of the afflictive views, and all of them are views. Okay. And they're all wrong views. So let me just tell you the names of them, and then we'll go through and talk about them. So the first one is called the view of a personal identity. Some people translate this. It's actually, the Sanskrit term is very difficult to translate accurately. Yeah. But view of a personal identity is kind of okay. The Tibetan, you know, when they translated the term into Tibetan, they really changed it so that when the Tibetan terms is translated into English, it means view of the perishing aggregates. Okay? So whether you hear view of the perishing aggregates, or sometimes view of the transitory collection, meaning the collection of aggregates, or view of a personal identity, they're all referring to this first one. The Tibetan term for it is jitta. So that's easy to remember, you know, not so many words. Then the second of the afflictive views is the view of extremes. The third is wrong views, actually. Fourth is view holding wrong views as supreme. And the fifth is views of rules and practices. Okay. Or there's other ways to translate it. Views of precepts and observances. Kind of, you know, just different translations. Forget that. Rules and practices. Yeah, or it could be of precepts and observances, or the Tibetans call it, I forget how they translate it sometimes. Okay, so these five are not reliable cognizers. They misapprehend things. However, because they have their own kind of logic, and logic is in quotation marks here, they develop their own erroneous convictions, yeah, that they're sure are true. And so because they use reasoning, even though it's incorrect reasoning, and because they distinguish their object and know its qualities, even though they misapprehend the object, these afflictive views are actually, they have a term for them, afflictive intelligence or afflictive wisdom. Yeah, it sounds really weird when you translate it into English, because how can you have afflictive intelligence or afflictive wisdom? Intelligence should be correct and wisdom should be correct, but it's because these ones, you know, use reasoning, because they distinguish their object and know something about it, even though they misapprehend it, it's an afflictive or deluded form of intelligence or wisdom. Okay? So they're not emotions, so to speak, you know. And you can see, you know, a view is different than an emotion. Yeah. In Buddhism, when you talk about all these different mental factors, though, they throw emotions and views and attitudes and mental factors that perform all sorts of different functions. They throw them all together. They're all considered mental factors. Okay? So, you know, sometimes it's interesting when you have Western psychologists dialoguing with Buddhist practitioners, because in Buddhism, when they talk about the mind and these mental factors, it's done from the perspective of what causes cyclic existence and what, you know, brings liberation. From the psychological view, they don't usually talk about views, you know, when they talk about, you know, minds that make you unhappy. They more talk about emotions, and not, they don't necessarily see the kind of views that underlay the emotions. You know, like if you went to a therapist, you know, would they say you're seeing the impermanent as permanent, you're seeing the foul as beautiful, and what is unsatisfactory by nature is satisfactory, and what doesn't have a self is having a self? Would your therapist question your perceptions or your emotions at that level? No. Yeah.
Otherwise, they'd argue if you brought it up.
Yeah, they may even argue if you brought it up. Yeah. Okay. And also, you know, when they're talking about the emotions, they see all those emotions usually as just taken, you take those for granted. That's what being a human being means, is, yeah, you have some greed, you have attachment, you have anger and resentment and arrogance and all these things. And mental health is just learning to navigate those so that they don't get in the go in the direction of being extreme and overpowering. But having a little bit of them, of each of them, is normal and natural and maybe even beneficial. Yeah, because if you're not attached to your own welfare, people are going to step on you. And if you're angry, anger lets you know that something's good and it helps you defend yourself. And, you know, and if you're conceited, okay, don't go to extremes, but, you know, kind of be happy that you're better than other people. You know, it's a very different take. Yeah, so you know, we shouldn't confuse therapy and Buddhist psychology. Yeah. Anyway, back to the views. Okay. So, ignorance, when we talk about ignorance, according to the Prasangikas, ignorance has two aspects. Part of it is a non-view. Part of it is a view. The part that is the non-view is just ignorance obscuring. The mind cannot see things clearly. There's obscuration. It's clouded. It can't discern things clearly. That's the part of ignorance that's a non-view. The part that is a view is that the ignorance not only is obscured regarding reality, but it actively apprehends things as existing in the opposite way from how they really exist. Yeah, so ignorance is definitely a view, and it's a completely upside down one because it perceives the opposite of reality. Okay. So, let's go through these five views. So the view of the personal identity, okay? It's an afflictive intelligence, okay, which, having apprehended the nominally or conventionally existent I or mine, grasps the I or mind to exist inherently. Okay? Sometimes we talk about the two self-grasping of persons, self-grasping of phenomena. Yeah, both of those fall under the category of ignorance, but view of a personal identity is a specific form of self-grasping of persons. Okay, self-grasping of persons is, you know, a mental factor or a mental state that looks at all persons and grasps them as inherently existent. View of a personal identity, from the Prasangika view, only looks at oneself and grasps oneself as inherently existent. Okay? So while we want to actually free ourselves from all self-grasping, be it self-grasping of phenomena, things that are not persons, or self-grasping of persons, yeah, the one that is the most troublesome for us is this view of a personal identity. Because this is the one that says, me, or I, or mine, my. Yeah? And so this is because what we're grasping at here is our own I and mine, you know, it becomes a very loaded mental state. Yeah. We don't get nearly as worked up about what happens to other people as we do what happens to us, do we? Yeah. Yes, you know, that beautiful person who's going to bring me everlasting happiness is truly existent. But when it comes down to it, who's most important? Who do I think about day and night? Yeah? Me! I! You know? And so this I and mine are I, me, my, and mine, you know. All of them are grasped as having their own essential identity, own essential existence, okay? So, yeah, the way this mind arises is first you have the appearance of the aggregates, our body and mind. So in persons and phenomena, our aggregates are considered phenomena. Okay? So when we talk of the five aggregates, form, feeling, discrimination, volitional factors, and consciousness. Yeah? So those five, yeah, appear, or any of those five appear. Then, on the basis of that, we give the label I, and there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, the I is something imputed in dependence upon the body and mind. But then we are not satisfied with just a merely imputed I, just a nominally existent I. Yeah. We think that I has its own nature from its own side. It's independent of everything else. And we apprehend it that way. And that's this view of a personal identity. Okay? Looking at the I. And here I is referring to the agent, the one who's doing things. I'm walking, I'm talking, I'm seeing things. You know, I'm revolving in cyclic existence, I've attained liberation, that I. Yeah. When we talk about mine, okay, mine is a funny kind of concept because mine is like the owner of the aggregates. It's still got to be a person. Usually when we say mine, we think of the aggregate. The aggregates are mine. The body is mine. The mind is, you know, feelings are mine. But here, it's not talking quite that way. It's mine as like the owner. Yeah, so mine is also as a person. It's the person in the form of the owner. Yeah? And we're very attached to the I that does things and the mine that, you know, holds on to everything, that owns everything. So among the different tenets systems, there's all sorts of, they don't all agree on what the view of a personal identity is, okay? Some of them say that the focal object of this view is the aggregates, And but the prasangika say actually the focal object is the nominally existent person. It's not the aggregates. Yeah. Some of the tenet systems say, you know, when it comes to grasping, you know, what the view is perceiving as a substantially existent person, or a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. The prasangika say, no, it's perceiving a truly existent or inherently existent person. So there's a lot of debate here, and it gets really kind of interesting and juicy, because according to how you define what this mental factor is, that's going to influence how you meditate on emptiness. Yeah, what is the object of negation when you're meditating on emptiness? Is it a self-sufficient, substantially existent person? Is it a permanent, partless, independent person? Is it an inherently existent person? Okay, so it's going to influence that. Okay, so then the second one is the view of extremes. So this is the second afflictive view, afflictive intelligence. No, it's the second afflictive view, which is an afflictive intelligence. And it refers to the self apprehended by the view of the personal identity. Okay, so that in the view of the prasangika is that inherently existent self, and holds that self to be permanent and eternal, or it gets completely distinguished and becomes non-existent at death. Okay, so this view of extremes is focused on, you know, what the view of a personal identity is apprehending. Like, there's a real me, okay? Or there's a real soul. Or there's a real controller that's me. You know, whatever you're defining, you know, whatever you're clinging on to in the view of the personal identity. And then you think that that one at the time of death either is eternal and permanent and goes on into the next life without changing, without any break, and is actually the same person in the next life as it is in this life. Or flip view, you think at the time of death the person completely becomes non-existent. Okay, so you see those two views in society a lot, don't you? Most, you know, theistic religions, there's a soul, and, you know, what's interesting in many of them, it's like the soul is the body, and that's why you don't cremate. In Judaism and Islam, you do not cremate, because... And some branches of Christianity, too, you don't cremate because on the day of whatever, resurrection or whatever it is, your body, which is you, gets resurrected and you are there again just as you were in this life before you died. That's the view of heaven, isn't it? You know? Kind of, you're the same person with the same family for eternity. Is that heaven or is that hell? I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay, but somehow you're exactly the same in the next life. Yeah, that's a wrong view. Can't be exactly the same in the next life. Or, you know, the way this view functions. If you can't be exactly the same person in the next life, then it's because who you are now completely disintegrates you are finished, non-existent at death. So what's missing in this view is the idea of a continuity. Yeah, that there can be a continuity of the person without the person in the future life being exactly the same person as the person in this life. Yeah, it's a continuity of this person, but it's not the same person. Okay, but you find these two views a lot. You know, theistic religions, yes, there's an eternal person who never goes out of existence. Science, you know, some scientific views, materialistic views. Yeah, when there's death, finished. Nothing. You're your brain. At the time of death, your brain ceases, you cease. Finished. There's no continuity of the person. Okay? So here we have, you know, right in our very own society, these two wrong views that people really grasp at very, very strongly, you know, and debate over and argue over and, you know. Then the third one, wrong views, is an afflictive intelligence that either denies the existence of something that exists or asserts the existence of something that does not exist. Okay? So, and here it's not talking about kind of superficial things, but actual, like the three jewels, you know? It denies, for example, the three jewels exist, but this view denies the existence of the three jewels. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha don't exist. Okay? Full awakening does not exist. Yeah? Or this view asserts the existence of something that doesn't exist, like people are inherently selfish forever and ever. Okay? So according to these kind of views that people hold, it really shapes one's whole way of relating to the world, whole way of thinking about yourself, whole way of living. It affects your ethical conduct and so on. Okay? Because, for example, if you think there's no such thing as awakening and sentient, you know, people are inherently selfish, then are you going to try and overcome your self-centeredness? No. Are you going to do a spiritual practice aimed at awakening? No. Are you going to have a view of sentient beings that is positive, that sentient beings, you know, actually have great potential? Or are you going to have a view that sentient beings are inherently selfish, full of ignorance, anger, and attachment, and there's no way to free them from it? Yeah? This is really going to influence how you see the world, isn't it? Yeah? If you have the view that, you know, people are just inherently selfish, and they're always going to have anger in them. They're always going to have attachment. It's futile to try and liberate that because those things are inherent parts of people. Then your whole way of relating to people is going to be very different than if you think that these people have the potential to become fully awakened. Yeah, because you're going to look at every sentient being and just think that they're a hopeless case. And you're going to think you yourself are a hopeless case. And then you're going to get depressed. Because there's nothing that can be done about our state of existence because this is who we inherently are. You know, these kind of views can really influence our life very strongly. You know? Whereas if you see people as having the Buddha nature, the potential to become fully awakened, then even if they do outrageous things, you think, okay, but that's not who they really are. Yeah, they can purify that. They can be completely different. That's not their real nature. Yeah? So then your whole attitude towards people is much more hopeful, much more positive. Whereas if you think, you know, just they're full of these afflictions, they're all terrorists, so, and they can't be anything but terrorists, so the only thing you do is kill them. Yeah? Views are only thoughts, but boy, are they powerful ones. Yeah? Okay? Another wrong view, there's no past or future lives. Okay? Now, the difficulty with that one is that if we think there's no past and future lives, then we're also likely to think that there's no such thing as karma and its effects. In other words, what I do now is not going to have any effect on me after I die. Yeah, because karma doesn't exist. Or I won't even exist after I die. You know, you have the second one, the extreme view. I won't even exist. So what I do now is not going to affect what happens after I die. So, but, you know, what use is ethical conduct? Yeah? Well, ethical conduct is helpful for having a good reputation, but I can put on a good show of looking like I'm ethical, but actually going around getting everything I want and harming other people while I'm doing it, and that doesn't matter so much because anyway, they're inherently stupid sentient beings, so no use caring about them, and my actions are not going to have any kind of results after I die, and so as long as I don't get caught by the police, doesn't matter what I do. Yeah? I mean, how many people, before they make, you know, before they go off and have an affair with somebody who's already in a relationship, how many of them think this could impact how I die and where I'm reborn? Nobody thinks like that. The image of the potential of pleasure is so strong. No, you know, people don't think about that. And yet, that kind of action is really going to influence what we're reborn as. Hmm? Okay. So, you know, most things, you know, when people get involved in negative actions, they aren't thinking of the long-term results of their actions because just the present situation seems so overpoweringly real that thinking of, you know, even in this life going to prison doesn't even enter the mind. Yeah? Because the view of this life is so strong, the greed is so strong, the anger is so strong. Yeah, and the wrong views just are there supporting it. Like, doesn't matter what I do. Yeah, as long as I don't get caught, it's okay. I used to think like that. Did you think like that? Yeah, I did a lot of terrible things under the influence of that view. Okay, so I'm going to read you a little part from the Supreme Net Sutra, also called the Brahmajala Sutra. This is also in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha talks about there's 62 kinds of wrong views. Actually, there's not just 62, but he, you know, yeah, categorized them in there so that the sutra at least had an end, you know. And didn't keep going and going. Okay, so there are the eternalists who proclaim the eternity of the self in the world. Yeah, so the self continues unchanged, the world continues unchanged. Those who are partly eternalists and partly non-eternalists, who proclaim the partial eternity and the partial non-eternity of the self and the world. Okay, so half-half. The finitists and the infinitists, who proclaim the finitude or infinitude of the world. You know, people can get really hung up, is the world infinite, finite, infinite, okay. There's also the non-eternalists who say, you know, nothing exists. Then there's a group called the eel wigglers, yeah, who resort to evasive statements. You know, well, it's not like this, not exactly like that. Okay, then there's another group called the chance originists, who proclaim the chance origin of the self and the world. Mm-hmm. This is very scientific, random. Mm-hmm. Yeah? No cause? Yeah? Just random arising of things. Then there's those who are speculators about the past, having fixed views about the past. Okay. And of course, those having fixed views about the present and fixed views about the future, you know. Those who claim a doctrine of conscious post-mortem survival, and those who proclaim a doctrine of unconscious post-mortem survival, okay. Those who proclaim a doctrine of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness post-mortem survival. Yeah. The annihilationist who proclaim the annihilation, destruction, and non-existence of beings. You know. There's those that say there's one supreme cosmic mind, then we're all chips off the old block. There's those who say that there's one primal substance that we're all created out of. There's, I mean, any kind of number of views. There, you know, infinite views. And there are those who are proclaimers of nirvana here and now. Okay. So, then the Buddha also, when he talked about, so we talked about the eternalist views, you know, things go on and on. Then the nihilistic views, he also talked about three different kinds of them. He put them all in three different categories. There's many kinds. So one that denies the continuity of the person after death, so at death time. Finish, no person, darkness, that's it. One kind of nihilism that denies the existence of constructive and destructive actions, mm-hmm. that says that our actions have no ethical dimension to them whatsoever. And then one that denies that things come about due to causes and due to concordant causes. A concordant cause is a cause that has the ability to produce that kind of event or that kind of thing. So some people deny causality, you know. It's just random. It's just chance, not due to causes. Okay? So the Buddha didn't call these wrong views because they contradicted his ideas. He's not that egotistical. But because these views were based on misunderstanding, misapprehension, you know, limited knowledge, distorted ways of thinking. And because these kind of views lead people to do a lot of negative actions or to have a really a view on life that is very unhealthy and makes you very unhappy. Okay, then the fourth of these wrong views is view holding wrong views as supreme. So this one is a view that thinks that all the wrong views, it's an afflictive ignorant intelligence again, that regards any or all of the first three views, the view of the personal aggregate, view of the extremes, and wrong views, as correct and the best view to have. So it's a view that's kind of proud of your wrong views. Okay? Because, it's really foolish, isn't it, to be proud of our wrong views. And yet we meet many people who are. Yeah? It's like, this is what I believe, and I'm sure it's right. And you people who believe in past and future lives, you're just, you know, living in la-la land. There's no proof for it. You know? And then you start talking about reasons, you start reasoning, you start, you know, talking about cases of people remembering, oh no, that's just all made up. Yeah? Okay. Then the fifth wrong view, or the fifth afflictive view, is view of ethical conduct and observances, or view of, what did I say before, rules and practices, okay? So this is a view that holds bad ethics and modes of conduct as supreme, okay? So it's a view that is mistaken about what is constructive and destructive. Yeah. So, for example, people who think animal sacrifice is the way to have to create merit. You offer you kill these animals and offer them to the gods, and that's the way to create merit and the way to be happy. So that's a wrong view about ethical conduct. Okay, or. You know, people who think that dying in battle against the heretics is virtuous and is going to lead you to heaven, being a martyr. There's so many martyrs nowadays, aren't there? Of almost any religion. You know, I'm willing to die for my religion. And if I kill other people who are adverse to my religion, then I even create more good karma, and I'm definitely going to get reborn in heaven. I mean, what kind of horrible wrong view is that? So that's definitely a wrong view about ethical conduct, isn't it? Yeah? Because they're thinking that, you know, like that guy from ISIS, you know, who's beheading people, he thinks he's creating virtue. He thinks he's doing something good for the world. I mean, this is what, afflictive intelligence does. What wrong views and ignorance do to us. Okay? Or in ancient India, and even nowadays too, there may be people with some kind of limited clairvoyance. So they'll see that, okay, so-and-so in a previous life was a dog, now they're a human being. So then they'll draw the conclusion, oh, being a dog and acting like a dog is the cause for being born as a human being. So at the time of the Buddha, there would be human beings, some of these recluses, you know, wanderers or renunciates from other sects, who would act like dogs. They would come and visit the Buddha, crawling on all fours, eat by putting their nose down like dogs eat. They would curl up in a ball the way dogs curl, and, you know, instead of sitting down and talking to the Buddha like a human, they would curl up in the dirt. Okay? Even nowadays, you have people in India standing on one foot for years, or keeping a hand raised above their head for years. People who do very severe ascetic practices. I mean, in the church, the way it used to be, self-flagellation, thinking that, you know, purified one of one's sins or stopped your afflictions or something like that. So all these kind of wrong views about, yeah, ethical conduct, about precepts and observances. Or you get people like the Brahmins who are very meticulous about how they do a ceremony. And it's like the value of the ceremony is you have to pronounce all the words correctly. The melody has to be correct. You can't forget anything, you know. So very kind of almost fundamentalists about how you do a ceremony. The value of the ceremony is not transforming your mind. It's in how well you and accurate you do the ceremony. Okay? Or people who think that, you know, drinking blessed water is going to purify you of your negativities. Now you're going to think, well, wait a minute. We just did that during noonday, didn't we? Mm-hmm. The water got passed out and we drank it. And we're supposed to think that, you know, all of our afflictions are gone, all of our cognitive obscurations are gone. Are you sure that's not this one, this afflictive intelligence? Well, except the difference is that we're imagining this. Yeah. Now, granted, some Buddhists do have this wrong view. And that's why, you know, at certain, you know, initiations or whatever, they will climb over other people to get the water. When there is a white Tara initiation and they pass out the longevity pills, people go crazy. Yeah. So actually, these pills are meant to help you meditate, while, you know, as an accessory to your meditation. Yeah, to help you think in a certain way. But people misapprehend and they think, oh, that pill in and of itself, if I get that pill, I'm going to live to be 100. Yeah? There's all sorts of wrong views. Okay? I can't say that all Buddhists are immune to these. It's not the case.
So why are we using them?
Because When you take one of those pills, yeah, if you think, okay, this was made by my teacher and that was this was blessed with recitation of a lot of mantra, so you think, oh, then it, you know, it has some special energy. Yeah, whether it has special energy or not is irrelevant, because this is a tool that's helpful to you. So you think it has some special energy. And then when you eat it, you imagine, you know, the negative karma that would make you have a sudden death, you know, that would, a negative karma that would prevent you from living your whole karmic lifespan in this body. You know, you think that's purified, and then you think of wrong deeds, you know, that you might have done to shorten your life, and you think, okay, I'm very sorry, and I purify those kinds of things. You imagine yourself filled with light. So it becomes a whole meditation that changes your mind, and that's very different than thinking this physical object has some special power. Okay. It's like our blessing cords, you know? Where's my blessing cord? Yeah. So the idea behind a blessing cord is that it has a knot in it, and you think the knot represents emptiness and dependent arising, and it makes you think about that. When you tie the two parts, the ends of the string together, you think about wisdom and compassion. But as one Lama put it, you know, we call this a protection cord. Actually, because the wisdom thinking about dependent arising and emptiness and the mind thinking about wisdom and compassion, they're our real protection. Okay. Yeah, that's what really is going to protect us. And he said, if you think this cord is going to protect you, you've got it all wrong, because you have to protect this cord. Because otherwise it's going to fall off and it's going to get shredded and it's going to get dirty. So, you know, don't think that it's going to protect you when you have to protect it. Okay? Okay, so these are, the five afflictive views that all get categorized under that one category of afflictive view that is the sixth of the six root afflictions. Okay, so we have some time for questions, comments? Yeah.
So I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding maybe the difference between the list of wrong views and holding the wrong views as supreme.
Oh, the different, you know, afflictive views that we have all have their different objects. You know, the first one's focused on the nominally existent I, the second one's focused on that wrong conception, the third one's focused on the three jewels or something like that. That one that is supreme views is focused on all the other wrong views and says they're the best way to think.
So it's being mistaken and proud.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's being mistaken.
No. Okay. It's being, what I think is really the right, best, correct way to think. My views are the best one, even though your views are completely wrong.
So it's believing a mistaken view without doubt.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Then there's these other groups of Buddhism that believe in maybe different ideas, would they categorize what we're discussing as a wrong view and then us holding that wrong view as supreme?
You know, I think there's actually a lot of debate within Buddhism about the first one, the view of a personal identity. And some people say that the Prasangikas are nihilists because these people don't understand the Prasangika view. So they think that because the Prasangika negate an inherently existent person, that then there's no person at all that exists. Actually, that's not what the Prasangikas are saying, and that's not what is entailed by negating inherent existence. So, but based on their misunderstanding, then they think the Prasangikas are nihilists. Yeah. So there's a lot of debate, I mean, from the time in ancient India going on until now, debate and discussion about these kinds of things. And the debate and discussion is seen as a really healthy thing because it helps you think, it helps you grow, it helps the tradition expand and really think about things. Yeah, instead of adhering to some kind of dogmatic view as, well, the Buddha said this, it's true. No use discussing it because it's right. No, that's not the Buddhist way. Yeah. Uh-huh.
His Holiness encourages people to stay with their own religion.
Uh-huh.
So by staying in one's religion that's perhaps theistic, then they become a better and better and kinder person. Mm-hmm. They're still practicing a wrong view. So I'm wondering how do the good deeds and the virtue overcome in time the wrong view? How does
mean? Okay. So when His Holiness, sometimes in the West, he'll tell people, there's no need to become Buddhist. You can practice your own religion. You know, and sometimes he even recommends that. But be a good Christian or a good Jew or a good Muslim or a good Hindu or a good Zoroastrian and keep good ethical conduct. And so you're asking, well, yes, that helps them keep good ethical conduct, you know, because as they say, you know, if sentient beings are created in God's image or Allah's image or whatever, then if you treat sentient beings well, it's a way of respecting God or Allah. Yeah, and so that helps, you know, that helps some people to develop kindness and to not harm other living beings, and that really benefits them. But you're saying at the same time, they're getting more and more familiar with a wrong view, such as how there being a creator God. Yeah? So what's the trick? You know, what's the story here? I think in this specific case, because the people, if they believe in a creator, it prevents them from doing so much negative karma, and it helps them to create so much positive karma, that outweighs the detrimental influence of habituating yourself with a negative view or with a wrong view. Okay? Because it's considered far worse to be nihilistic than it is to be theistic. Because somebody who says there's no karma, there's no past and future lives, they're going to go do anything and not think at all of the ethical ramifications of their actions. Whereas a person who believes in a creator God, then they will modify their actions and try and restrain some of their impulses in order to please God. And that benefits them. Yeah? So they say if you have to choose between being an eternalist or an absolutist and being a nihilist, be an eternalist. You know, don't be a nihilist. That's much.
And for some people it's confusing. You confuse them more, and it's not good for them.
Right, yeah. Some people, if you start undermining their idea about God, they become very confused, and it's not at all good for them. Yeah? So many times people ask me, you know, I'm helping a friend or a relative who believes in another religion. Yeah, what do I do? And I say, you talk according to the tenets of that religion. Because that's what the person has faith with, that's what they're familiar with. That will help them to have a positive mental state when they die. And that's what they need when they die, is a positive mental state.
I remember having a conversation with my mom, you know, and I was in the New Age and all that stuff, you know, and I was so excited and I always believed in reincarnation and all this. But when I was trying to talk with my mom about that, I was creating more chaos.
Mm.
There was no connection between us because she was resisting to
it. Yeah.
Then there was no connection at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was not helping nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why, you know, if people aren't receptive, then it doesn't do much good to talk to them about specifically Buddhist ideas. What I always do, you know, in that kind of situation, is I talk about the parts in Buddhism that agree with what that person already believes. And, you know, they say, do you believe in God? And I don't look at that question, and I say, we practice ethical conduct, and we believe in being kind, and we believe in forgiving others, and we believe in having compassion, you know? And then people, you know, they have a good view of Buddhism, and they are kind of encouraged in their own spiritual practice. Hmm?
Can you talk a little bit about how it is that ignorance pervades all of these mind states? I mean, like, it seems like it gets
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just talk about
it. So they say that ignorance accompanies all these mind states in the sense that none of these afflictive mental states are going to rise unless ignorance is there. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So unless there's this basic misapprehension of how we exist, how phenomena exist, then you aren't going to get the arising of all these other afflictions.
So it's always there. Even when our mind is kind of neutral, even through just the appearance of...
The ignorance isn't always manifest, but
Almost always. But remember that you can have ignorance manifest and still have a virtuous mind. That ignorance itself is not non-virtuous. Yeah, because you see at our level, when we think of creating merit, you know, I want to create merit. There can be some eye grasping in there. But, you know, it can still be a virtuous mental state. That karma is still polluted karma because it will ripen as a rebirth in samsara. But it's definitely virtuous. Yeah, even though there's the self-grasping underlying it. Okay?
So, quite a general question, but how do we know when we have distorted views?
How do we know when we have distorted views? This is the problem. Is that sometimes we believe so much in something that we're totally unaware. So if you have some faith in the Buddha's teachings and you learn like the four distortions and the five afflictive views, and you think about them and you make many examples of them from your life so that you really understand what these things are, then there's a better chance when you have one of them that you'll say, oh, this is what I was, you know, contemplating after I heard that teaching. But if you don't contemplate this teaching, and you just take your notes and don't study them, or you don't even take notes, or you don't even think about it afterwards, then it's going to be very hard to identify those wrong views. Yeah, so that's why it's really good, you know, to think about these things and make many, many examples, either from your own way of thinking or think of the wrong views that you see in the world around you and even sometimes in your family and friends.
Mm-hmm. Question. Mm-hmm. Can you compare and contrast grasping at a self versus the psychological and healthy sense of self we need to navigate life?
Okay, compare and contrast. The whoa, in 25 words or less? The, what was it, the ignorant sense of self?
The grasping
itself. And then the healthy sense of self. You know, His Holiness often says that to practice the bodhisattva path, you need a healthy sense of self. You need to have self-confidence. Okay? So you can have self-confidence without having self-grasping. Yeah? For us, when we just have a sense in our own a confidence in our own good abilities, and we're not conceited or arrogant about it. We just recognize what is there as being there. Yeah, then we're still not free of ignorance, but we have a healthy self-confidence. Okay, when we look at our good qualities and we get kind of egotistical about them, yeah, I'm really kind of better than other people when it comes to this, and I have an advantage over other people because I'm smarter, and you know, this kind of thing, then that's definitely going to be afflictive views, okay, and ignorance. So it just depends the extent to which you are, you know, reifying the self. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at our level, not having realized emptiness, we don't see the self as a dependent arising, so we may not have a correct view of the self. But there's three ways to view the self. One is as inherently existent. One is as empty and like an illusion. And one is neither. Mm. Okay? So the one that is seeing the self as inherently existent is grasping at the me. Grasping at the I. The one, and that's held by, you know, sentient beings. The one that And but it's not held by Buddhas, okay? And it's, that's not present in the mind of Aryas and meditative equipoise. The second view, seeing the self as empty or as like an illusion, that is only in Buddhas or in Aryas, those who have realized emptiness directly. Then the one which is neither, you know, is just kind of a mixture of the conventionally existent self with an inherently existent self, but you're not grasping that self as inherently existent. So it's the way that you see the eye when, you know, you're just sitting somewhere and there's no strong emotion and you just say, I'm sitting. And there's no strong emotion, there's no strong anything, and you, I'm sitting, or I'm walking. Yeah? So that, you know, way of viewing the eye is reliable. You can distinguish a person. And on the basis of that, you can create some good karma. Yeah? By generating, you know, saying, I want to create merit, and yeah, I want to practice the Dharma. Okay, so you can do that without grasping at a an inherently existent person.
Mm-hmm. In Asanga's Compendium of Higher Knowledge, it is stated that there are three wrong views. One, direct wrong. Two, indirect wrong view. And three, enmity-based wrong view. What are the differences between one and two? It's a direct and indirect wrong view.
I'm not familiar with those. So maybe if the person can send me some more information and explanation about that, then I can help interpret that for them. Okay. Shall we end? Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Bear and such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratra Mandala Kamnirya Tayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, Thandrai group supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Travasti Abbey in the West Flourish.